Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Support for LAist comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years of Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, with over 200 films May 1st through 10th. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California or listening nationally or worldwide on the LAist app or at LAist.com. Saturday night, we had our annual gala at the Langham Hotel in Pasadena. What a blast! Followed by a dance party with JT and friends afterwards. Just a wonderful evening. Money raised to support the nonprofit journalism that you hear on LAist 89.3 and at LAist.com and our podcast from LAist Studios. So thank you for those of you that were there. It was wonderful to meet so many of you and really hear about how important the programming is for you here. So thank you. It's a terrific night, Saturday evening. Today, our program's really devoted to Earth Day. Even our opening segment is really one with strong environmental impact. And that has to do with the story you just heard from Suzanne, in which UCLA's Donald Shoup was talking about the connection between building parking spaces and the number of people who end up driving, and his contention that the research shows it increases congestion to provide parking spaces. But there's, of course, another big economic issue that's at play, and that is if developers of housing don't have to build parking spaces, if they don't have to excavate under the units or set aside some of the acreage of a development site to parking, they can build it much less expensively. And the hope is that if you do away with parking requirements, you can make housing much more affordable. The flip side, if people in those units have cars, they need a place to park them, and that's going to be the street. Joining us to talk about all the issues that are at play with efforts to either cut or do away with parking requirements is LAist housing reporter David Wagner. David, so good to have you with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry.
I mean, this issue has been one that's been around Los Angeles a very long time. We have transit-oriented developments that have had cut the number of spaces for cars. One of the things that was found later on is that many people still had cars, didn't take public transit, but liked all the cool amenities of living in a transit hub. Let's talk a little bit about what the latest developments have been in this area of restricting or eliminating parking requirements.
Well, yeah, it might be surprising to some people to hear that in car-centric LA, there are thousands of new apartments getting built with no on-site parking in the city of LA right now. And really, changes in state law are what's behind this. So Laura Friedman, a Burbank State Assembly member, wrote a 2022 law that bans cities, actually, from requiring parking in new apartments if they're within a half mile of a major public transit stop. There's also the state's density bonus law that allows developers to either reduce or get rid of parking if they're building affordable housing. And what we're seeing lately is that developers are really seizing these opportunities. A recent study from this real estate data firm, ATC Research, found that 3/4 of affordable housing projects that are being fast-tracked in the city of LA right now have no on-site parking.
None at all. So this isn't just like a single space per unit, but none. And we should talk about what a huge difference it is in construction costs, because it's a massive difference.
Absolutely. It is expensive to provide parking in new housing in a place like urban LA, where land is very expensive. It basically means, excavating, pouring concrete for an underground parking structure or, a first floor parking structure. And once you start using concrete, once you start doing that kind of excavation, it just increases the cost exponentially. Studies have shown that on-site parking increases construction costs of new housing by $36,000 a unit. It raises rents, according to some studies, by around $200 a month. So, you know, you might see a new building advertising that it has free on-site parking, but it's not really free. You're paying for it in higher rents. It costs more to build that kind of housing, and tenants make up that cost at the end. You know, and there are housing advocates out there who I talked to for the story who say, you know, if a tenant doesn't have a car, they want to be car free. They don't want to have to pay for a parking spot that they're not going to use anyway. They should have the option to live in a building that has no parking.
One of the challenges, I think, though, is that for affordable housing or moderate income aimed housing is, you know, for many people, they're still commuting significant distances because a lot of times people don't have the money to live close to where they work. And so a lot of the residents are probably going to fall into that. They may have jobs working at restaurants in Beverly Hills, let's say, but they're living in a much lower income part of Los Angeles County and then having to commute from there. So the issue, you know, with our still being built out public transit, it's sort of how do you account for that with these developments?
That's the big question. I mean, you know, even with some of those investments you've been talking about, new train lines opening up, investments in other modes of transportation, LA is very car-centric. I mean, to kind of state the obvious here, more than 90% of LA County households still have a car, according to census data, and people need to find a place to park them. So this can obviously be one of the most frustrating things about living in LA. And I should note that, you know, we are seeing these requirements being dropped under state law. But even with the requirements going away, that doesn't necessarily mean all developers are going to get rid of parking. I talked to one affordable housing lender who said, you know, on the projects that she's involved with, yeah, it makes sense to get rid of parking in dense urban areas with a lot of bus and train lines. But when she's looking at a project deeper in the San Fernando Valley, even if it's not technically required, they are still going to provide parking in those situations because tenants expect it. And she worries as a lender about finding enough tenants in an area like that who would want to give up their car. That could be a tough thing to convince tenants to do in certain areas.
And so then would they be able to charge market rate for rents, that sort of thing? We're talking with David Wagner, who's LA's housing reporter. I'd like to hear from you what you think of this state law, which allows for the housing that is aimed at affordable housing in the market to go without parking requirements. What do you think about that? 866-893-5722. Does that trade-off in your mind work, or is it not a good trade-off? 866-893-5722. Or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Janet in Culver City emailed, reducing parking spots is a great way to encourage developers to build affordable apartments. However, small grocery stores need to be built within walking distance so people don't have to drive for necessities. Perhaps in the vacant commercial space on the ground floors of apartment buildings. While everyone agrees affordable housing is needed, more housing needs to be built for sale. Not all millennials want to rent studio and one-bedroom apartments, but want to buy property to build wealth and have room to work at home and have children. Unfortunately, this means moving farther away and driving more. That's Janet in Culver City. And Janet, you know, I'm sure as you know as well, the challenge with a small grocery outlet is just the costs of that. That, you know, so much of retail supermarket business is based on volume. If you're just a little place trying to, you know, acquire fruits and vegetables and food to sell, your prices are going to be so high just because you don't have that kind of buying clout. So, and that means then again, residents would be paying a huge premium for the food and goods that they would be buying at those little storefront places that are in walking distance. 866-893-5722. And if, you know, if folks go to Costco, for example, how are they going to get their goods, you know, back to their apartment?
Well, the one interesting point on the grocery stores piece, there was a vote last week at the LA County Board of Supervisors. They you know, were voting on new parking rules in unincorporated parts of the county. And part of this addressed that issue. You know, so one of the things that they passed is allowing larger developments to cut the amount of required parking they have on site. you know, significantly in some cases by up to 50%. But they, in order to do that, they would have to provide some perks such as like car share spots, electric bike charging stations. And one of them, one of the things they could do is provide space for a small grocery store on the ground floor. You know, they even, this is of course how it works in cities like New York, you know, people buy their groceries at bodegas. It was interesting to me to see the County Board of Supervisors even use that term bodega, which is kind of, you know,
I think it was an East Coast term.
I know, it's unusual for LA. But, you know, there's thought being given to this from the policy side. You know, if people are going to go car free, they're going to have some other options for getting their groceries. And, you know, maybe smaller stores on the corner are going to become more common in some of these areas.
When I was a kid growing up in Inglewood, we had within two blocks of our apartment building four little mini. One was a drive-through dairy, and then three other little mini markets. And I mean, it was a whole different time, of course, but it was amazing. Four places, you know, plus there were supermarkets, of course, that were farther away. 866-893-5722. Bill in Irvine, good to have you with us. What do you think are going to be the effects of eliminating parking requirements for moderate and low-income housing? Oh, I'm sorry. Bill, go right ahead.
I was going to say that, well, first of all, I don't think that it's a good idea to eliminate on-site parking in all situations because of the very problem of the problem with the neighbors, and you're going to end up with a political firestorm if it's done in inappropriate locations. So, but that said, I think it makes a lot of sense to reduce the parking. And the way to do that is to not require covered parking, not require assigned parking. So the parking could be commonly used, and that would lower, it's way more efficient and lower the need for the parking. The other problem, many cities require garages, even in affordable housing. And the people close the garage door, use it for storage, and the parking, you know, it's no longer effective. I don't understand that requirement.
Bill, I appreciate it very much. It sounds like that requirement is not still operative if you're talking about construct. Is it for buildings where all the units are available for low-income housing?
That's one way to reduce or even get rid of parking requirements, yeah, or just build housing near public transit, and then that state bill makes it so that you don't have to provide on-site parking.
Let's talk with Barbara in Hollywood. Barbara, good to have you with us. What do you think about eliminating parking requirements for new construction? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting used to a new phone system where I select the callers again, and I keep forgetting to select. Barbara, I've just put you on the air. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm really, when I moved to LA a little over 20 years ago, my friend counseled me, make sure you move into a building that has parking. And for the first few months, I didn't have it. I was on her couch and I had to drive around. And it was a pretty safe neighborhood. It was Franklin Village. But I have parking and I live in Hollywood. And I am grateful every night. You know, this is a safety issue. It's going to land, as always, on the people with less money because the luxury high-rises are going to continue to have parking. But somebody's going to get raped. Somebody's going to get attacked. I'm sorry. There's a lot of issues in Hollywood, and people roaming around that are on drugs or mentally ill. I'm not trying to be alarmist, but it is a safety issue. And if they really wanted to put time into this, and I don't know if Karen Bass will ever hear this, but they could set up a form that's very simple when they're allotting low-income housing. Let people indicate if they want to, it's a little more work, but let them choose if they want to live in a car-free building. And that way you can keep costs down, but not land it on the shoulders of somebody who needs a car and is driving around in the middle of the night, you know, and walking blocks back to their house. It's really a really important safety issue, and economics always trumps safety.
And people who have any sort of mobility disabilities, also it's an issue for them, you know, bringing things back to their apartment as well. Not everybody is able to walk long distance or even walk at all. So that's an issue too. Barbara, thank you very much for that. Let's talk with Josh in, Hold on just a moment. Josh, in Mid-City, Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, so nice to be here, and thanks for bringing this up. This is an issue going on in our neighborhood right now on residential streets near Pico and Crenshaw, where they're already starting to put up some low-income apartments without parking requirements. And it's having an impact on the residential parking that we have on the streets that our houses are located on. And there are plans to build significantly bigger and more apartment buildings without on-site parking. And so we've actually been looking into this, but our biggest concern, in the interest of brevity, is that how it will impact our own ability to park at our residences, which it's already starting to do.
Now, some places have permitted parking on the street. Is that something your neighborhood's considering?
Yeah, and we've been looking into that. It's actually quite a long process that has to go through multiple reviews over a significant period of time. And given that the brunt of the biggest projects that are being planned to go up in our neighborhood haven't gone up yet, at the stage we're currently at, we wouldn't meet the requirement for permitted sign parking. Mm-hmm. But it can take a couple years for that to happen. We were hoping we could get started now, but because of the testing and assessments that take place.
Big process. But yeah, I know I've friends who live in on a street in the Fairfax district, and when I go to their house, I have to get a parking permit to put on my car to show that it's okay to park there. David, something just to share about that process?
Well, that one interesting thing about that is that there is this state bill right now that, if passed, it could make it so that people who live in these parking-free buildings, these buildings that have zero parking, could not get a parking permit in these sorts of districts. This is a bill authored by Senator Anthony Portantino here in Glendale. And basically, it aims to ban cities from issuing those overnight street parking permits to residents who live in zero parking apartments. So, you know, if people did expect to move into these buildings and park their car on the street, if there is one of these parking permit districts and this law passes, it could be very difficult. They'd have to find a private garage to park or give up their car.
Christopher in Los Feliz says you shouldn't be able to build housing without parking. If you live in L.A., most likely you have a car. I can't afford to live where I work. I commute. This just doesn't work. That's Christopher in Los Feliz. Mary in Santa Monica says, I live in a unit with street parking in Santa Monica. It's family unfriendly. It's a very small demographic that non-parking buildings work for. Lauren in La Quinta says, makes all the sense in the world to reduce on-site parking for units where you have nearby transit. Where you don't, the people that these units are supposed to help can't live in them. Without transit, they can't get to their jobs. And let's see, we also have Ken emailed, I moved to a very old apartment building in Glendale, only had street parking. It was a hassle trying to find parking every day, especially when I came home late from work. When COVID hit, I started working from home. I decided to get rid of my car, but I had to get, I became an avid cyclist when I went back to work. All right, thank you, Ken. And Pamela in Altadena says some malls and strip malls have parking lots. Could they be used in some way to provide low-income housing parking? Manny in Burbank emailed, no on-site parking's a mistake. Not having parking for residents is a disservice. The objective should be to keep cars off the streets. That's achieved by providing spaces facilitating that goal. Like it or not, working people need and want to drive cars. We want to have passengers carry cargo and go places. It's called freedom of mobility. And Denise in Crenshaw Manor emailed, if it's now easier for developers to avoid providing parking, is there any discussion making it easier for homeowners to replace curbs to facilitate the option of parking in their front yards? Boy, I think Denise, there would be so much pushback to the parking on front lawns or in front yards. But that would be interesting to see if that's something. Has that been talked about that you've heard about, David?
Not that I've heard, no.
Yeah. All right. And Cara in Hollywood says, unfortunately, I don't think it's fair to not allow parking. I think Mexico City has a good setup where they alternate license plates of who could be on the road, which days. That'd be a much more proactive approach. This issue, though, really, Cara, is about the affordability of the construction. Yes, I mean, obviously, there's a push to incentivize getting cars off the streets. But David, this is really about cutting the cost of building, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, the stat that I talked about earlier, 3/4 of these new projects featuring no on-site parking, that is in income-restricted housing. It's in housing that's designed for people who make $70,000 a year or less for the most part. This is going to be, you know, housing that rents for, you know, around $1,700 for a studio. And, you know, the housing advocates I talked to for this story said, you know, we are in a huge affordable housing shortage. And if we want to build more lower cost units, there are going to be there are going to have to be some trade-offs. And in their minds, you know, that trade-off is not a hard one to make. They want more housing and they're okay with sacrificing space for cars.
David, thanks very much. And you can read his in-depth pieces that he's written on this topic at LAist.com. And we'll look forward to you covering, as so many of these projects get built, what the repercussions are on neighborhoods.
Absolutely. Thank you, Larry.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. David Wagner with us, LAist housing reporter on LAist 89.3. This week only, we're giving away tickets to see LAist listener and friend of Air Talk, John C. Reilly, as he takes the lead in his latest vaudeville spectacle, Mr. Romantic. Reilly and his band of multi-time Grammy winners will be on stage at Largo in West Hollywood this coming Saturday, April 27th, breathing new life into beloved tunes of the Great American Songbook. You could be there. To enter, visit laist.com/Mr. Romantic. That's all one word, laist.com/Mr. Romantic. And don't wait until Thursday. The giveaway ends Thursday, so do it right now. We have much more to come on Air Talk, including a Supreme Court hearing this morning, arguments made on a case involving homelessness throughout California. We'll be back in a minute.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Coming up a little bit later, we'll talk with Los Angeles Times columnist Pat Morrison. Her wonderful book, Rio LA, looks at the history of the Los Angeles River. And for our Southern California history segment on this Earth Day today, she'll be with us, talk about the history of the L.A. River. But we turn our attention now to oral arguments presented this morning in a Supreme Court case with significant implications for California and other Western U.S. states. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that bans on camping in public places violated the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution by punishing people who have nowhere else to spend the night, who were living on the streets. You have heard, of course, controversy over anti-camping ordinances in Southern California cities that had been rendered largely unenforceable because of that Ninth Circuit decision that you have to have beds for people to be able to safely sleep in if you're going to be ejecting them or giving them a ticket for camping in a public space. Joining us is Politico's California Politico reporter, Jeremy B. White. Jeremy, so good to have you with us. This is a case with really big implications for California cities that want to enforce anti-camping ordinances. And explain what's at stake here.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here. It is a big deal for California cities. I think that's why you've seen numerous big city mayors weigh in on this in support of the Supreme Court, essentially overturning or rethinking the Ninth Circuit's decision. You've seen Governor Gavin Newsom ask that. You've seen congressional Republicans even representing California. So there is some unusual bipartisan agreement on this across different levels of government that the types of legal restrictions that this ruling put in place essentially prevent cities from moving people off of streets and sidewalks. And this is obviously an extremely visible problem in pretty much every city in California. And it is striking to me just how broad the opposition to this legal framework has been.
And of course, we have advocates for people that are living on the streets who say that this criminalizes something that people have no control of over if there aren't shelter beds available for those individuals to be able to spend the night. You know, what recourse do they have? Their argument is essentially you are criminalizing people based on their poverty. We'll have to see how those arguments play out in front of the high court. But this is a very contentious issue, Jeremy.
There's no doubt about that. And similarly, we have seen rulings in San Francisco, for example. There was a ruling related to these rulings that strictly limited what the city could do to move folks when there were not enough shelter beds available. That is really the fundamental question here is if there's not a place to put someone, can you force them to move along? You saw Supreme Court Justice Kagan really push on this point this morning saying, are you effectively criminalizing people having nowhere to go? It does seem like the conservative majority is more sympathetic to undermining or doing away with the earlier rulings. But that is the fundamental question. If there's not enough beds to put people in, what are the legal obligations that cities and counties have towards those people on their streets?
And, you know, if the high court overturns this, I guess around June is when we'd be expected to hear their decision on this challenge. If the high court was to overturn the Ninth Circuit decision on this, it would be fascinating, Jeremy, to see what cities actually did with that, because that court sort of starts then the whole other controversy about on the ground, what are cities going to try and carry out, if anything?
That's right. And depending on how whatever the court rules is written, that will, of course, shape what cities and counties are able to do. But of course, Los Angeles already passed an anti-camping ordinance, as have other cities, for the most part, trying to conform what they believed the law allowed. It seems like there's a good chance the law is going to allow something different sometime later this year. And I have no doubt that cities and counties throughout California are going to be scrambling to catch up. There's a reason that everyone from Governor Newsom's office down through mayors, city council members are paying close attention to what's happening at the Supreme Court this morning.
The plaintiff in this case is the Oregon town of Grants Pass. And I was wondering, well, gosh, you know, why is it their challenge? But I was reading, Jeremy, and you may have more information on this. I'm not all that aware, but it sounds like Grants Pass had a problem from resident standpoint that there were many people camping in parks in the city, and residents had been complaining about an inability to use the public parks. And I was wondering, you know, that may not be the issue, but I was wondering if that made them perhaps a more sympathetic plaintiff before the court.
That's a good question. I think the justices are examining the larger legal questions here, more than being influenced by the sort of sympathetic identity of the plaintiffs themselves, as you put it. But I do think that question of what do you do with public spaces is one we've seen come up over and over again. There was a huge sweeping lawsuit in Los Angeles, essentially tackling this issue, in which a lot of the plaintiffs were people who owned businesses downtown or disabled people who couldn't use sidewalks because they were covered in tents. And so, of course, there are some societal obligations to people who are unsheltered and where you can find a place for them and the times at which you can force them to move along. On the other side of this, whether in this Supreme Court fight or in legal fights you've seen play out all over the state, You hear from plaintiffs who say, look, public access to sidewalks, to parks, to other public spaces is being restricted by people camping there, and that the folks who need to use those spaces have some legal rights as well. And so that's really the balance that the courts are trying to figure out here.
All right. We're talking with Jeremy B. White, Politico's California Politico reporter. John in West L.A. says, why are we deciding this at the national level? Cities know much better what they need to do. This should really be done city by city. The federal government shouldn't be involved. Well, John, the reason that the High Court is taking this up, as I mentioned earlier, is because the Ninth Circuit, their decision was that what cities were trying to do with the anti-camping ordinances violated the U.S. Constitution. That's so I hear what you're saying, but that was the reason why the federal decision came down. Although it was so interesting, Jeremy, that it only applied to jurisdictions within the Western U.S. under the control of the Ninth Circuit. My understanding is that then other parts of the country were not bound by this.
And I think that is part of why you've seen it appeal to the high court. As your listener noted, homelessness is essentially a city and county issue in terms of how frontline public officials are responding to unhoused people. But there is a lot of confusion out there because there's one standard governing Western states. There's lots of different ordinances. And so I think trying to find some uniformity is a big part of this. I would also note it's not a coincidence that the pertinent Ninth Circuit ruling is covering the West Coast states, because a lot of the really dire homelessness crises you do see in California, Oregon, Washington, even to a certain extent, increasingly in places like Idaho. And so I think the fact that this major ruling affecting homelessness is happening and a court that governs places where that crisis is most acute is not a coincidence.
You mentioned Idaho. I think Boise challenged this ruling a few years ago, and the court didn't take it up at that time. But, of course, homelessness, particularly in the U.S. West, has become an even bigger issue in the intervening years, as you were just saying. I think the latest I saw, Jeremy, is California has a third of the nation's homeless population.
California definitely has a disproportionate share of the nation's homeless population. As you pointed out, there was actually an earlier court case very similar to this coming out of Boise that the Grants Pass case sort of built on or superseded. And so this is a longstanding issue for these Western cities where it's been a problem for decades, of course, in places like San Francisco, and is increasingly becoming a problem in pretty much every major city in the Western United States, not to mention other parts of the country.
Jeremy, always good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. From Politico, California political reporter Jeremy B. White with us on Air Talk. Coming up, my friend and the terrific LA Times columnist Pat Morrison, so knowledgeable about LA history. And that's why she's the perfect guest for our Southern California History segment on today, Earth Day. Pat has written a great book, Rio, Los Angeles, Rio, LA, about the LA River. We'll be talking with her about the history of the river when we come back in 90 seconds.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis, or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. And I have some exciting news about a Film Week event we have coming up next month. I'll tell you about that a little bit later, but I can't wait to get Pat Morrison, Los Angeles Times columnist, my friend for many, many years. And she pulled a fast one on me when she was on April 1st for the 39th anniversary of Air Talk, commandeering the show and turning it into a tribute to Air Talk. It was a very, very meaningful day for me. And thank you, Pat, again for doing that. That was wonderful. But I'm glad we finally get to talk about the history of the LA River today.
And I'm not snatching away the football.
That's right.
No tricks.
All right. Well, one thing just before we get started, I want to hear from listeners. I think a really important part of the segment is, what do you particularly love about the LA River? What are your hopes for it? If there's a particular stretch of it you particularly enjoy, maybe you walk or you bike along it, or it's close to your neighborhood, a place you particularly enjoy, please share it with us at 866-893-5722, where you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. If there are also particular things you would like to see happen with the LA River in the years to come, please share that with us as well at on our website. It's one of the places you can do it, las.com/airtalk. So, Pat, the LA River used to go all over the place years ago before it was channelized. What is the earliest information we have about the path of the river?
The path of the river, as we know from the path of Native American villages and settlements, was pretty much where it wanted to go. This was the source of water for Los Angeles, and so you didn't mess with that. You honored it. And it went some years, as you know, it would flow to a mile wide in the rains, but some years in the summer it would just be a little trickle. And so to channelize something that had such a wide range in a way sort of violates the spirit of what being a river is, but it also was part of the demands of Los Angeles of the moment. So we have had from the beginning conflicting expectations and needs for the LA River.
And, you know, we should keep in mind, too, that, you know, we've all grown up or arrived in Los Angeles that's paved over, that different waterways like the Arroyo and Bayona Creek are channelized and the like. But, you know, much of Los Angeles, particularly in the West LA area, was swampy back in earlier history. And when we had Native Americans living in California, they really worked around what could be a lot of visible water, a lot of mud. You know, that was all kind of drained and put into the channels in the early 20th century.
Well, until the 1820s, the river went from where USC is now. It flowed west. It flowed out along where the Santa Monica Freeway is, and the scout, Kit Carson, said he would ride that path, and the grasses would be up to his saddle. They were so high. And so somewhere underground in Santa Monica and Palms is probably enough peat to make L.A. scotch if anybody wanted to
take. That sounds good to me. I might give that a try.
Because there was so much water around, and we changed, in a way, the water behaved and made some of it disappear and made some of it useless where it had been useful as groundwater before.
We're talking with Pat Morrison, author of the wonderful book Rio LA, Tales from the Los Angeles River. If you have questions about the history of the LA River, or just as importantly, if you'd like to share a part of the river that's particularly meaningful to you, that you really enjoy, we're at 866-893-5722. Pat, what was life like for the Tongva who lived and used the river a great deal?
They understood the behavior of the river, that this was not a river that was going to behave itself. So when they built their huts, their beautiful willow huts, their woven huts, they built them with respect to where the river was going to be. And if it happened to flood that year and take out their willow, the sort of geodesic dome way ahead of our understanding of it, it took it out. They just rebuilt after that. But they built their villages like Yangna and around Cahuenga and up into the valley with a sincere respect and understanding of how that river had behaved for years, for millennia, and that it was a source of life and sustenance, and they respected it accordingly.
And what about fishing? Was there steelhead at the LA River?
Yeah.
And
yeah, steelhead trout. That was supposed to be the great sign that the river had returned to its health, was when steelhead trout. And Larry, I understand there are fly fishing expeditions organized in the LA River. Now, there's no guarantee you're going to catch anything, and there's certainly no promise that you should be eating what you catch. But the fact that people are fly fishing now in the LA River is quite an accomplishment.
It is. It is. You know, let's sort of jump ahead to more recent years. Lewis McAdams, Friends of the LA River, FOLAR, they really helped, along with your book, bring to public attention what the river's history was and efforts to try and recapture that history. Share his importance, please.
Lewis McAdams should rank in the pantheon of LA heroes because he brought the river to public attention after decades of people not knowing it existed, treating it like a garbage chute. And it began when he and several friends, who I gather from Lewis had been smoking a little something,
Willows, reeds,
got the fence to get into the bed of the LA River, which was a crime then. And as a poet, tried to take in the spirit of the river. He did a piece of performance art where he painted himself blue and green and dressed in a white suit and channeled the spirit of William Mulholland. It was pretty badly reviewed. His girlfriend left him. Still,
oh, poor Lewis.
Persevered and brought this river to our attention. At one point, he engaged in an argument with someone from the Army Corps of Engineers, which deteriorated to Lewis saying, "It's a river," and the Army Corps of Engineers man saying, it's a flood channel," arguing back and forth just over the terminology, which, as we know, is so significant to perception.
Well, and we've had so many efforts to try and find ways of naturalizing the river while at the same time protecting communities that are close to the mouth of the LA River, low-lying communities like Long Beach and others that are along the river in southeast Los Angeles County. And Pat, that debate continues today, of course.
This is why I've begun to think in this context of the river as a plural. There are several LA rivers because every community through which it passes, and the bulk of it passes through the city of Los Angeles, every one of those communities has a different perception of the river. Some think of it as a wide open space, a beautiful natural resource. For others, it's a potentially destructive thing, and they're glad those walls are there. And so when we talk about restoring the river, we really need to pluralize it because the river has different personalities for the different needs of the places where it flows.
You know, so many people have asked me over the years, why is downtown Los Angeles where it is? Why didn't they put it along the coast? And you can answer that question. Why is downtown where it is?
That's where the fresh water was. That's where the river was. The Native Americans knew it when the Spanish arrived. They recognized it, too. The Portola expedition that came up through recognized the river valleys of the Arroyo Seco and what we now know as the Glendale Narrows. They recognized that the water, the fresh water, was where you would settle. The coast would do nothing for you. Los Angeles didn't have a natural harbor. There was no natural outflow to the river. So this was the place. And so I like to flummox my West Side friends when they say, "Where do you live?" I say, "East of the river."
That's perfect.
And for them, the geography doesn't mean much. But this is where downtown, this is where the city was founded.
We're talking with Pat Morrison, author of Rio LA, Tales from the Los Angeles River, and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and so knowledgeable about Southern California history. And she's with us for today's Air Talk Southern California History segment to talk about the Los Angeles River. I'd love to hear from you. What are your favorite parts of the river? What questions do you have about it? Liz in Southgate has one. We'll get to hers when we come back. We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. We'll be back in a minute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. I think it's very appropriate during our Southern California History segment with Pat Morrison that we announce our upcoming Film Week screening, the series returning, and you're going to have a chance to come out. Tickets are limited, but get yours now to come out and see the classic film, Double Indemnity. It stars Fred McMurray, the great Barbara Stanwyck, Edward G. Robinson. We're going to be screening Double Indemnity at Vidiot's, the nonprofit theater in Eagle Rock in Northeast Los Angeles, on Saturday night, May 11th. Now, tickets are very limited, so if you want to join us for a screening of what is considered the grandparent of all noir films, Double Indemnity, directed by Billy Wilder, great cast, great screenplay, terrific Los Angeles locations, then please get your tickets right now. They're available at LAist.com/events. That's LAist.com/events to join us Saturday night, 6:30 p.m., May 11th at Vidiot's in Eagle Rock. After the film, I'll be leading a post-screening conversation with Film Week critic Claudia Puig, and we'll be talking with the co-authors of a new Turner Classic Movie book about Double Indemnity and its influence on the genre of film noir. There's all kinds of shady dealings in Double Indemnity, one of my favorite films of all time. I chose it for the return of our Film Week screening series at Vidiot's Saturday night, May 11th, 6:30 p.m. post-screening conversation I'll be leading following. I hope to see you there. LAist.com/events. We're talking with Pat Morrison about the history of the L.A. River. Pat, are you a Double Indemnity fan?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Plus, set in Glendale, Silver Lake, downtown. How can you not
Los Feliz. I love the house in Los Feliz, which I understand is still there, where Barbara Stanwyck's character lives. So, yeah, and I think there's a Hollywood Farmers Market. Yeah, anyway, all kinds of great locations in that film. Liz in Southgate says, in Southgate, at the L.A. River, a lot of cleanup projects are being done as interest in the river is renewed. And she's wondering if you are familiar, Pat, with any of these different cleanup initiatives and you know, what information is available about those?
Friends of the Los Angeles River should have on its website information about the schedule for cleanup. We're approaching the date of the Gran Limpieza, the Great Cleanup, which was one of Lewis McAdam's contributions, where school kids and families and volunteer organizations get out for a day, ideally a beautiful day in Los Angeles, and clean up the crud from the Los Angeles River, not only from to keep it out of the river and keep it from going into the ocean, but to create a sense of community about the river. And these projects have only grown over the years. And I'm very glad to hear that Southgate is taking part in it too, because this is the part of the river that flows through places that are afraid of the river, that if the walls weren't there, the water would endanger these communities that grew up a lot after the river was paved. So I think this sense of engagement speaks to how much we need park space and open space and how much we want it to be high quality. I mean, after all, the river was the dream project of Frank Gehry. This was the ultimate great canvas of his career that he's talked about. So all the people who help and pitch into this help contribute to that big canvas of the reimagined river.
Pat, my favorite spot is that which has some of the natural feel to it through Atwater Village and Los Feliz, where you've got the natural bottom. You've still got the concrete sides, and the river's particularly wide there. It has to be because it doesn't have a concrete bottom. But that area where trees are growing in it, you can actually see some rapids when we have rain. It's really a beautiful stretch of the river, and my understanding is just because of the composition of the soil there that they were not, I guess the water table's too high or something, they weren't able to put concrete on the bottom, but we're the beneficiaries of how pretty that is.
That is exactly right. The water was so persistent. This is at the foot of Dodger Stadium and a little north of that. The water was so persistent in its presence that they couldn't pave it. And the argument for years was that the Army Corps of Engineers would come in and essentially shave away all the growth, the trees, the bushes that grew there in order to make the water flow faster. but the environmental organizations won that argument. And so these little islands remain. And as you see, Larry, they're home to birds, fish, rabbits, all kinds of wildlife that now populate the river. My concern is that by 2028 with the Olympics, that we have something presentable to present to the world with this river that is not exactly the prettiest, that we have something going on, increased bike paths, perhaps little paddle boat areas, restaurants along the river, pop-ups
nice.
That will attract people.
And I know that with our previous Mayor Garcetti, he had said, you know, that this was a major priority to get development along the river that would really, you know, be very nice for residents, create just the kinds of spaces you're talking about. But I haven't heard much about those projects lately.
And I understand that Metro has said that it will not have the promised bike paths all done by 2028, which is a big disappointment because I think people will come here to enjoy the wide open spaces of Los Angeles, and some of it won't be available to them. I mean, certainly we've made the river now a centerpiece of environmental restoration in Los Angeles, but that does not mean it's going to be an easy journey.
Chris in Mammoth Lakes emailed, "Where are the headwaters of the L.A. River?"
The headwaters of the L.A. River can be argued as the confluence of a couple of creeks in Calabasas that come together in, actually, I think it's a high school football field or around a high school football field. But the watershed of the river is immense. It goes all the way from the back of the mountains in Malibu over to the San Gabriel Mountains. And it's an immense watershed. And even though the L.A. River and the Mississippi River drop at the same elevation, the Mississippi River does it in 2,000 miles, and the L.A. River does it in 50 miles, which
wow.
is why you see this kind of water slide effect of immense amounts of water moving very quickly down a very steep set of passages, waterways, and concourses.
And it's why, what was it, 10 or 15 years ago, they raised the height of the levees at the southern part of the river down toward Long Beach because of concerns about potential flooding when you have major storm events. Pat, thank you as always. Such a pleasure to get to talk with you about the L.A. River on today's Southern California History segment. Thanks so much.
Always a treat to join you, Larry.
Thank you, Pat Morrison. I can't recommend her book highly enough, Rio LA, Tales from the Los Angeles River, published by Angel City Press. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and it's Earth Day. I've been looking forward to this for the past week or so because most of our program has been built around environmental topics. Coming up a little bit later this hour, there are two segments that I myself was particularly interested in, pitched to our producers, and we made it happen. So coming up a little bit later, we'll talk with the Theodore Payne Foundation's. Our guest will be Evan Meyer, who's executive director of the Payne, which is a garden as well as teaching program on native plants and wildflowers of Southern California. So Evan will be able to answer your questions about the California native plants and what might work for your garden. I'm really looking forward to that. And then our final segment this hour is no special guests. We're opening up the phones because I'd like to hear your favorite California gardens. They can be public gardens or private gardens, just place that you really find transformative, that gives you peace. Maybe they're particularly beautiful plantings at the garden. So we're going to open up the phones for you to share that with us later this hour. But we begin with composting, which is now required under California law and which still continues to vex many Californians who try to figure out, well, how do I do this? What do I need to do it? What's my local city or county doing with composting? And to help in that whole process, our climate emergency reporter here at LAist, Erin Stone. Erin, good morning.
Larry.
So let's talk about, what does the law say, the 2022 going into effect law?
Yeah, so this law was passed back in 2016, went into effect in 2022, and it's basically all about food waste and the amount of food waste that ends up in landfills. So the goal of the law is to quit putting food waste in landfills where it decomposes and emits methane, which is a really powerful greenhouse gas that heats up the planet. So the goal is to now, instead of that food waste going to the landfill, it's either donated before it goes bad, or it's composted, or it is turned into fuel.
And what different cities have different ways of running these composting programs?
Yeah, so a lot of it depends on who the waste hauler is, the infrastructure that is available at or nearby that city, or what makes the most sense in terms of bills and the amount of costs that might go up with that. But yeah, it's a law has to do with the waste haulers and the contract with the waste haulers and whether they have they're already working with composting facilities, and these are large scale composting facilities that are often farther away. The one that LA uses is out near Bakersfield, or they might have more partnerships with like an anaerobic digester, which is the type of process that turns food waste methane into fuel.
And I know for apartment livers, this can be particularly challenging.
Yes, a lot of renters and apartment dwellers have not seen this roll out yet. And I've heard a lot from listeners and readers who have found this frustrating because they want to participate in the law. They don't want their food waste to continue going to the landfill. So it's kind of on its own timeline, and your landlord is required to participate in this law. So starting a conversation with your landlord, asking what's going on, calling your waste hauler yourself and saying, hey, why don't we have a green bin? What are we supposed to do if you have a communal dumpster? That's what I had to do. I mean, supposedly it's already separated. So starting that conversation is a good way to get that process going. And now the law is being enforced. So you can submit a formal complaint to either CalRecycle or your city, and they will be required to look into that.
All right. We're joined by Erin Stone, LA's climate emergency reporter. Also with us, the executive director and founder of LA Compost, a community-based composting group which serves communities throughout Los Angeles County, Michael Martinez. Very good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Very properly dressed with your Dodger cap. I commend you on that. Very good after our big 10-0 win yesterday. So, Michael, let's talk about this being a hodgepodge, I'm assuming, of cities and unincorporated county and every, what are some of the biggest questions you get?
Yeah, some of the biggest questions that we're receiving is, to Erin's point, when is my multifamily unit going to be served? I see my neighbor who has the green bin that was offered by the Organics RLA from LA Sanitation, and just a lot of confusion and nuance, like complexity to this rollout, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. We're talking about the state of California. And even in LA County, there's different haulers and municipalities that serve different zip codes and regions and jurisdictions. But the question I get a lot about is, I'm hearing about fines. There's this fear about getting that metaphorical slap on the hand. And we really try to educate folks that the fines really isn't on the individual user, but more so those that are required to pick up that material. But we're really just trying to allow folks to understand the various choices and options they have for composting, from composting in their backyard to in community with us to working with these municipal systems that are beginning to roll out.
For those, because we're talking most specifically about food waste, what are some of the best ways for people to manage that, to do home composting?
Yeah, one of the biggest things I recommend folks to do, and I know it's perhaps a controversial piece of advice, is really utilizing your freezer. Freezing your food scraps throughout the week just makes the composting process much more enjoyable before you even go in that backyard to put in that pile. A lot of these pails that we're getting, people are putting under their sinks on their countertop, and by day two or three, it's fruit flies starting to smell, and there's a little bit of a turnoff. If it's this bad already, what's it going to be like in my pile? But when you freeze it, put those things on pause, you build some frost, and you take it out to your pile or drop it off at one of our hubs whenever your schedule allows you to do so. So your freezer is really a best friend in this process.
We have a little shelf devoted to just what you're saying, not a freezer for that purpose.
Same so. Just as I.
And it works well because you don't have the odor issue, as you're saying. And you mentioned drop-off locations. So you run drop-off locations for compost?
Correct. Sure. So similar to dropping off a piece of mail at the post office or dry cleaner or something, or a book returning back to the library, we create different community hubs, both at farmers markets, community gardens. We have over 40 locations, but a big influx has been our farmers market drop-off program. People, as I mentioned, freeze their food scraps throughout the week. They drop it off at our booth, and then they shop for their fruits and vegetables for the following week. And it's a really nice opportunity to see that full story of food in a single moment. And what's nice about our drop-offs, which is supported by LA Sanitation, is we are composting that material probably within a 5-mile radius of point of collection.
Nice.
So let's say, for instance, we're collecting at the Hollywood Farmers Market every Sunday. We have a small hub at Griffith Park just down the street that we're processing same day. And then we give that material back to the community for them to really access that resource.
Hearing Aaron talk about the location near Bakersfield, where, I mean, that we sort of blanch at that given what the fossil fuel usage is going to be to truck it up there. So the fact you're doing it within 5 miles, that's impressive.
Yeah, and to Aaron's point, there's really a hierarchy of priority, right? The priority with this SB 1383 is to really look at food diversion that's still edible to begin with, looking at how can we get this food to those who are food insecure. And then as far as priority goes, I really recommend backyard composting because that's as local as it gets, community composting, and then, of course, the municipal options as well.
We're talking with Michael Martinez, Executive Director and Founder of LA Compost, a community-based composting group which serves Los Angeles County. If you have questions for Michael or our climate emergency reporter, Aaron Stone, we're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com, and you can post on the AirTalk page, las.com/airtalk. I know there are some cities that collect composted waste in plastic bags in yard waste cans, but then I don't understand how that works, because then the yard waste can is picked up and dumped into the same trash truck. So does that ever get separated out? I bet bags break. How does that work? Either of you know?
Yeah, so that was a big question we got from a lot of our listeners in response to our survey about this law. Why plastic bags? Plastic bags we generally want to get rid of, right? So what I have learned is that is largely to keep those waste streams separate. Like in Pasadena, for example, much of the food waste will actually be diverted to be converted into biofuel or fuel, which is basically natural gas, which is primarily composed of methane, and the yard waste will be composted. So they want to keep that yard waste, just the general green waste that you have from your yard, separate from that food waste, because they're actually going to separate.
But it
waste
goes
streams.
Into the same truck, which then compacts everything. How did the bags survive compacting in those trucks?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, that is why they want these plastic bags instead of the flimsier kind of compostable bags, which won't be composted either way. Those can rip apart, and then that's probably not going to be separated. Not every city is necessarily separating it in this way, like Pasadena. It might all be going to the same place, but that's why they ask for these plastic bags that don't rip really easily in part, so that they can keep those things separate.
Let me share a listener comment. This is from Michael in Tustin in Orange County. We had no choice but to start composting in our condo unit. Other residents don't follow the rules. Also, the bins have a ribbed bottom where all the scraps accumulate, which is a terrible design, Michael says. Either of you comment on the design of the bins?
That's a fair point. I mean, yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, there's a lot of little things that come up when you start doing this that you realize, hey, like, is this working all that well? But ultimately, I think calling your waste hauler really asking the questions of where does my waste go from my address? You know, I did this myself because we have a communal dumpster, and, you know, mine does end up going to a facility where everything's laid out and separated before it's then transported to where it goes. So there are transfer facilities where, you know, there's stops along the way before it just is out to Bakersfield or out to whatever facility it's going to. There's an anaerobic digester in Rialto, for example. So, you know, I think this is an opportunity for folks to really ask those questions and get the specific answers for themselves so that they can make a decision about what they feel most aligns with their values or what they want to do or is most convenient for them in the time that they have.
Margaret in Long Beach emailed, the number one question at a book talk by the Zero Waste Chef was what to do with dog poop. The answer, kick it under a bush. No, that's not it. Depending on, not on your neighbor's lawn, definitely. Michael, I wanted to ask you, though, about how are cities determining what are best practices in this way? Are they following up to research, you know, their contract haulers, how they're dealing with this? What's your sense of the follow through?
Yeah, I think the learning has definitely been in the doing and really learning based on these lived experiences and these questions and comments and concerns from the general public. I want to just reflect and remind ourselves that we're very early on in the implementation. Right. And I can imagine that these hiccups also occurred when recycling was enforced.
Oh, it did.
Right.
It did,
folks
definitely.
Were, why is my bin not blue? Or why is this compactor on the street? So I'm very much in a position of compassion and grace, knowing that it's always going to get better.
I'm so glad you brought that up, though, Michael, because I remember when recycling started, and it was really hard for people to figure out, and what do I do with it? And it's funny, now we just sort of automatically do it. But it took a while to shift our habits.
Yeah, and I am seeing the city respond to general comments and reflections from their constituents. The very fact that the city's supporting us to be at more farmers markets is one vote in confidence to know that they do care about the community option in addition to backyard options. But I just know that the city is just trying to saturate solutions, which I think is really important. It's not a one-size-fits-all model, but how do we focus on food recovery and backyard and community and citywide diversion? But I think the biggest thing is ensuring that everyone has an option, and I think that is a bit of a gap right now with multifamilies, and knowing that that needs to happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Michael, what about different food types? Are there certain foods that you can't compost or shouldn't add to the other food scraps in there?
That's a great question. I mean, anything that was once alive can be composted in the right environment and conditions. And every hauler and every bin and every collection service does have different requirements and parameters. The common denominator really is your general fruits and vegetable scraps, loose leaf coffee grounds, yard waste, things of that nature. What starts to get into question territory is like, can your hauler compost meats, bones, dairies, fats, bread, salt, things like that? Others is compostable products, which is very much a wide spectrum of not knowing what those ingredients are. For us at the community level, we do kind of limit meats, bones, dairies, fats for our drop-offs, just because we are composting in parks and in community areas, so we want to be mindful of best management practices. But I would just very much, to Aaron's point, look at your hauler's website, at least for the city of LA. Organics LA gives you a full, robust list of what you can put in that green bin as well.
We're talking with the executive director and founder of LA Compost, a community-based composting group serving Los Angeles County. Michael Martinez is with us, along with our climate crisis reporter, Aaron Stone, joining us. If you have questions about composting, got a couple more minutes here for our conversation. We can get your question at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Diane in West Los Angeles says residents should know there's no charge for the city of LA for green and blue bins, but the black bins cost money. So I don't know what are the differences with each of those. Are you familiar with those, the colored bins in LA?
I'm pretty sure it's kind of like a bundled cost in the bill. I do know that regardless if you have a 32-gallon bin, which I have at my house, which is the smallest, or the 96-gallon bin, which is the largest they offer, the cost remains the same. So I do, if it is in fact the charge on the black, I know that it is more of a bundled price, to my knowledge, from my sanitation bill.
All right, 866-893-5722. I would assume that you have some folks who contact LA Compost, Michael, and they've been on board with this for quite a while, but they want to know, what can I do more? How do I take this to the next level? What can people do?
Yeah, and I love those individuals who've just been a part of this journey for a decade. It's the same people who shop at the farmer's market, the same people who grow their own food, the same people who have options to shop elsewhere but still choose that more preferred prioritize option. And for us, we've just seen this beautiful user experience of people dropping off with us, people volunteering with us. Majority of our staff were volunteers, now turned staff members. So it's just really been incredible to see how people have been facilitating this knowledge sharing across LA County. My biggest thing is educating yourself and building and growing your community. Nothing about this climate emergency is going to happen alone in regards to our response. So I think it's really important that we remember that nothing about composting or large systems, it happens in isolation. So learn with your neighbor. Offer these services to your neighbor. I've seen really incredible folks who have backyard bins who allow their neighbors who live in apartments to drop off right next door. And there's really cool websites like Make Soil that has like a network of folks like that. So I'm just really encouraged by folks not just limiting it to their own experience, but how can I allow for this to be transcend my own kind of household as well.
And Michael, your organization, I know it's a standalone nonprofit, but then do you have contracts with governmental agencies?
So we do joint grant applications for federal dollars. So like, for instance, we were awarded a USDA grant in partnership with LA Sanitation to open up more farmers markets, more public parks to process this locally, offer more workshops and so on. And we're very much seeing our work it's very complementary to the work of different municipal agencies like Rec and Parks and LA Sanitation. And we view ourselves as complementing their work versus competition. We're very much education focused first and really allowing folks to have that user experience in the community and really normalizing compost. It's not just this back of yard in the shadow activity, but we're doing it at schools, churches, museums, community gardens, places where people are naturally doing life. And in the same way, if you have an aluminum can, you look for that blue bin. Eventually, I want to normalize, hey, when you're done with that food, like start looking for that compost and asking where that is. I hope that to be the normal situation and habits moving forward.
I wish we had time for your origin story of the organ, because it sounds fascinating how you got this going, but we'll have to leave that for another time. Jeff in Grand Terrace, good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Thank you so much, Larry. My name is Jeff Allen. I'm a council member for the city of Grand Terrace. I want to address the question earlier about the plastic bags of compost or plastic bags of scraps being put into the green bins, the garden waste bins, and we were required to do that in our city because our carrier that we contract with does not use an anaerobic facility, and therefore what they do, this is Burtec, what we contract with, they separate the bagged waste from the garden waste. They actually have employees at that bulk facility that'll separate those bags out so that they can produce California legal mulch. Which I learned this from them. There is mulch cannot have compost or food scraps at all in it legally, or it can't be called mulch. But compost can have anything in it. And so there are certain customers that want pure mulch, and so they separate that out, produce compost for some customers, mulch for others. There's another carrier close by, CR&R, and they have an anaerobic facility. So those customers do not need to separate with bags in their garden waste. They put it all in and it all goes to anaerobic digester. That is why we have to separate. And I just want to make sure people understand that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it. From the Inland Empire community of Garden Terrace, or Grand Terrace, excuse me, just north of Riverside. Erin, were you going to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just shows that how different each city is and how important it is that you engage with your city and ask, where is my food waste going? Where call your waste hauler. I think it's a really good opportunity for folks to really learn about the waste system as a whole. And I know for me, it's been eye-opening to learn about that. So I think it's a great point that it's different everywhere.
I know I'm holding you over time, but I got a couple more good questions. Briefly, Bill in West LA, I have a kitchen compost container. I live in a multi-unit building with a green container. What kind of bag can I use for the compost?
You can use a paper bag to separate. That paper bags can actually be composted themselves.
Well, that's what we see at a lot of our farmers markets. A lot of the people that bring their food scraps put it in a Trader Joe's Sprouts regular unbleached paper bag, and after they dump it, they literally just tear it up, so they're leaving empty-handed. So any reusable container or paper bag is totally fine.
And Connie and La Quinta, I compost, but I'm getting a lot of fruit flies. Can you put moldy fruit in your compost?
You can. That's where the freezer comes into effect as well. Putting that food scraps in the freezer kind of eliminates. I've seen people put double-sided sticky tape on the lid of their containers as well. So as fruit flies kind of elevate, it kind of eliminates that. So there's a lot of tricks to it, as well as layering it with newspaper or sawdust or things of that nature.
Yeah, or paper towels even, right? That can be composted as well.
Thank you both so much. I've learned a lot. I appreciate you coming in. We look forward to doing it again, because obviously composting a big topic for our listeners. Aaron Stone is LA's climate emergency reporter. Michael Martinez founded and is executive director of LA Compost, a community-based nonprofit composting group serving Los Angeles County. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. Coming up, we're talking California native plants with Evan Meyer, executive director of the Theodore Payne Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants. If you haven't been out to their gardens in Sun Valley, it's tremendous. They have core classes out there about native plants. Really a great place. But he's with us in studio to answer your questions about California natives. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. It's Earth Day. I was looking forward to this program because so many interesting things about our local geography, our environment here in Southern California that we've focused on. And now we turn our attention to the native plants of our region. From the Theodore Payne Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants, Executive Director Evan Meyer is with us. Evan, good morning. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day, Larry.
So good to have you with us. Last time I was at your gardens in Sun Valley, I was just impressed with all the people that are out, classes going on, and so many people walking up the hillside through the gardens. And I'm just curious, this time of year, when we're into the spring, is this one of your busiest times for visitors?
It gets really busy this time of year. It is when everything comes together and the flowers are blooming. And it's sort of like all the work that's gone into these native plant gardens across Southern California come to fruition this time of year, and it's just absolutely beautiful.
Well, we have Evan here, so he can answer your questions about California native plants, particularly Southern California and even the different zones that we have here in Southern California for plants. So if you are looking at adding into the mix more California native plants, wildflowers into your garden, if you're going to make a complete replacement with California natives, either way, it's a chance for you to ask questions about certain types of plants. We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. You can also email your question for Evan at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. We should probably start with the difference between drought-tolerant plants and California natives, most of which probably are drought-tolerant because of our local climate, but not all drought-tolerant plants, of course, are California natives.
Yes. Drought-tolerant means low-water plants, and there are low-water ecosystems across the whole world, deserts, Mediterranean type climates like Southern California. And when we talk about drought tolerance, it's a pretty broad terminology that's used to describe any plant that doesn't take a lot of water. California native plants are the plants that evolved here and were here prior to colonization, so have evolved for millions of years in this ecosystem. So they're very different than drought-tolerant plants in their attuned to the very specific climate of Southern California, the wet winter, hot summer. And they also are co-evolved with all the animals that live here, the birds, the butterflies, the lizards, the native bees. So drought-tolerant plants can save water, but they cannot restore habitats in the way that native plants can. So we advocate as an organization for removing lawns, moving away from artificial turf, and bringing native plants back into our cities. And it's a great thing to talk about on Earth Day because this is a really low-hanging fruit for environmental progress. We can really have huge impacts with a pretty simple thing, which is just picking different plants when we think about our gardens and our landscapes in Southern California.
One of the things that I appreciate about going to the garden is the diversity of plants, because most of us just aren't that familiar with what was here before humans. And to be able to see that there are a lot of choices that you can make is exciting. Are you still at a point where you're learning about some of these plants and trying to cultivate different ones there at the Payne Foundation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, gardening is a lifelong journey of learning. And there are 6,500 or more native plant species in California. We're the most biodiverse state in the United States. So there is always something to learn. And we're always kind of tinkering and seeing, will this work? Will that work? And that's what keeps it fun. There's so much work to be done with rethinking how humans can use gardens as an environmental force. And that's really, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do. Think about the entire industry of landscaping, of gardening, of horticulture as a way to improve the environment.
We, of course, have seen with people planting drought-tolerant landscaping a lot of use of succulents and of cacti. And I wonder, how many of those are California natives? Is there a wide range of cactuses and of succulents that are available?
There are a lot of native cacti, particularly in the deserts, and succulents like the Dudleas or Live Forevers. So if that's the aesthetic that you like, yeah, you can definitely do it with native plants. I would say when you go into like a big box store and look at their succulent selection, most of those are coming from Mexico or South Africa, and they're not California natives. So there's a huge diversity of ecosystems across California. And when we say California native plants, it's sort of like, pretty broad. So when we hone in on the types of ecosystems, that becomes really important when we're talking about habitats. So here in Los Angeles or in Pasadena, the ecosystem that would have been here prior to development would have been something called coastal sage scrub. And so when you're picking plants from the coastal sage scrub and getting really specific in that way, you can really be restoring the local ecosystem through those plant choices. And there's some beautiful, wonderful plants. There's California sagebrush, which is sort of names this ecosystem, has a wonderful smell. They call it cowboy cologne, and it'll bring that smell to your garden. There's white sage, incredible, beautiful plant that's starting to flower now. And those flowers will set seeds. It'll have these long spires of seeds, and the birds will start landing on them and just dive bombing your garden. So making those hyper-specific choices is the way to really create habitats in your garden.
And what's the advantage, let's say you're looking at succulents, of using ones that were native to Southern California area versus ones that are imported from Mexico?
Well, outside of the creating habitat for the organisms that evolved here, which is a big one, there's also an issue of when the water comes to those plants. So there are winter growing succulents and summer growing succulents. A lot of the big box store drought-tolerant succulents are actually summer-growing succulents.
Oh.
So they might be low water in the sense that they only take a certain amount of water per year, but they actually need that water in the summer when it's not raining, versus our native cacti and succulents are much more adapted to that winter rainfall. So the timing of when they get watered via the rain is really important, and that's going to come into play as native versus non-native succulents.
I would have never thought of that. We're talking with the Theater of Pain Foundation's Evan Meyer. He's executive director of the Theater of Pain Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants based in Sun Valley. We're at 866-893-5722. Kim in Rancho Palos Verdes says, I've heard a lot of mixed information about milkweed to attract monarch butterflies. I heard there are invasive species of milkweed. Can you explain the difference between the different types?
Yeah, so there's a lot of native milkweeds in California. The one that we see most regularly used in gardens is the narrow leaf milkweed. But then there's also a non-native milkweed called the tropical milkweed that a lot of people use in their garden. And that's probably what the caller is asking about. That can be invasive, meaning it can escape cultivation and start to propagate itself. And there's a lot of controversy around tropical milkweed because it doesn't go dormant. So it doesn't die back like the native milkweeds do. And that can throw off the migratory cycles of the monarch butterflies. There's also issues of mites that are harbored on the tropical milkweed and just sort of disrupting the whole cycle because it's a migratory cycle starting in Mexico, coming up through North America. And when the plants are doing strange things that the butterflies didn't evolve with, it throws the whole thing off. So we always recommend utilizing the native milkweed species.
Wow, fascinating. Kim, thank you very much for that question. Robert in Fullerton said 3 years ago, we replaced our lawn with native plants. Our water bill went down 80%. We've also seen a big increase in wildlife. We faced a lot of challenges, so we ended up doing all the design and work ourselves. That's Robert in Fullerton. Very, very nice to hear. And I'm sure that you, Evan, love hearing the success stories of people who've adopted this, who've done it, and really love the results.
Yeah, that's a common story of people getting rid of their lawn, bringing in native plants, saving a lot of water, building habitat. And he also talked about doing the work himself. And that's something that is really wonderful about this is just getting out in your garden, getting your hands dirty, being in your front yard and meeting your neighbors. There's a whole lot of community building that is part of it too. And, you know, it's just a wonderful way to spend your time. I love gardening. In my day job, I don't get to do it much anymore, unfortunately, but when I leave work, I go and I always go into the garden and just start pulling weeds and
that's so
getting
funny.
Out there.
What we used to call busman's holiday. Sarah in Santa Monica says, what native plants will grow well in containers?
There's a lot that do well in containers. For smaller plants, things like dudleas, which are I talked about there, it's a type of succulent, mm-hmm. Also known as live forevers. Those do really well in containers. If you have a bigger container, something like a hummingbird sage, which has a beautiful smell, almost like the smell of watermelon, the leaves, and that will actually attract hummingbirds in containers. We've seen people sharing videos of their patio gardens with hummingbirds diving in to feed on the hummingbird sage. Plants like coral bells also can attract hummingbirds. And then if you get into really big pots, we see all sorts of things working. We've done planter projects with sage, species of sage like white sage, toyon. Some of the really big plants can be done in large containers. So really a lot work. And we do a container gardening class that goes over all the plants that work well in those conditions.
Toyon, I wouldn't have thought of one that would do well there.
You need a really big pot for
that one. Yeah, I would bet. Roy in Mission Hills emailed, where can we find resources to design a front yard with native plant and bee-friendly flowers that's low cost or free? I've been trying to find help as a beekeeper. I'd love to plant more native flowers, but every site seems to cost quite a bit of money.
Yeah, there's a lot of resources if you can kind of piece them together and do a little bit of do-it-yourself, take on it. Our website has tons of information for free that has all sorts of planting guides and plant profiles. There's also a website called CalScape that is run by the California Native Plant Society, and that you can actually type in your zip code, and it'll tell you what plants would have grown there. So between those resources and books and visiting nurseries, there's a lot of information out there to make the change to native plants.
Evan, before I let you go, our next segment, we're just going to open the phones for listeners to share their favorite gardens of Southern California. But for those who are going to go to Theater of Pain now, what are they going to see, and do they need to make special arrangements to visit?
No special arrangements. We're open Tuesday through Saturday, 8:30 to 4:30. They are going to see a lot of flowers, the annuals in particular, blooming right now. And I love this time of year because there's just so much color. And we're hitting that stride of spring where it's like everything is happening simultaneously. And there's one flower which I love to see because it's so beautiful, but it always makes me a little sad to see, is the Clarkia, also known as Farewell to Spring. And they're starting to bloom. So that signifies that spring is happening now. Get out and enjoy it. And summer is on the way.
Wow. And that is the nickname of the plant, Farewell to Spring?
Farewell to Spring is the name. So every time it blooms, I'm kind of like,
wow.
Oh man, spring's almost over.
Oh my gosh. Evan, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about it. We appreciate it so much. And it reminds me to get out there again to the Theodore Payne Foundation in Sun Valley. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Evan Meyer is the executive director of the Theodore Payne Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants, a nonprofit that has a mission of educating us about the native plants of Southern California and ways that we can incorporate it into our gardens, or even, as you heard from him, even patios and balconies with contained plants as well. So as I just said to Evan, we're opening up the phones. I want to hear from you your favorite gardens of Southern California. It can be a hidden gem. People don't really know much about it. It can be a private or a public garden. We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. We'll be back in 90 seconds. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Now I'm asking you on Earth Day to share with your fellow Air Talk listeners your favorite gardens to visit in Southern California. I know there's so many parts of our region that have little tucked away, maybe smaller gardens that are real finds. So please share with us. Some of them I know are open very limited hours or maybe one or two days a week. So I'd be interested in hearing from you about your favorite place to go to see beautiful plants and flowers and trees. Where in Southern California, which of the gardens are particularly important to you? We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and your first name. You can also, on our AirTalk page, put there which gardens that you particularly enjoy visiting. Go to las.com/AirTalk, and you can share with us there some of your favorites. You know, we were just talking about California native plants with Evan of the Theodore Payne Foundation. They have a beautiful garden, of course, but there are also other places, for example, Descanso Gardens in La Cañada, Flint Ridge, which for this week of Earth Week has an Earth Day native blooms display that have been all been curated by Descanso's horticulture staff, and they're doing demonstrations. Milkweed and other native plants are included in that. Descanso Gardens, one of my favorites, built into the hillside. It was actually the home and gardens of a newspaper publisher. I believe it was the guy who published the LA Daily News. It was his home and his gardens, and now it's run as a nonprofit. Descanso Gardens, absolutely beautiful. They're well known for their tremendous display that they do at Christmas time, where the gardens are all beautifully lit. But during the rest of the year, they have all kinds of seasonal exhibitions as well. That's Descanso Gardens in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. But I'd like to hear from you, your favorite. It can be a portion of a garden if it's a large place like the Huntington Gardens in San Marino. Maybe it's a particular part of that that you just particularly enjoy. 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@las.com. please include your location and first name or post on the AirTalk page at LAIST.com/AirTalk and share some of your favorite locations for gardens in Southern California. Let's start sharing some of those. Let's see. Omani, our producer, says the botanical gardens, the Huntington, my favorite. I recall the summer of 2020 having a chance to go, beautiful array of plants at such a depressing time with the onset of the pandemic. Well, and our Southern California gardens during the pandemic, Manny, the attendance just skyrocketed because it was one of the outdoor places that we could go where we'd have plenty of space and wouldn't have to be close to other people and could unmask and be out in a beautiful natural environment. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. I mentioned that there are some of hidden gardens as well. One of them is Arlington Garden in Pasadena, right near Huntington Hospital. It's very close to our studios in Pasadena. It was started by Betty and Charles Kicker McKenney back in 2005, a public garden where it was a vacant lot that they had, and they turned into this incredible, beautiful gardens. Arlington Gardens in Pasadena is one of those places. Admission is free, and it's just something that, you know, people outside of Pasadena might not be aware of. Michael, in the West Adams District of Los Angeles, what's your favorite garden? Michael, go right ahead.
Hey, Larry. My favorite garden is the sort of secret garden in the back of the Vela Slavice Theater at the Union Theater in West Adams.
Really? So what's the specific intersection of that theater?
I believe it's on Hoover and 23rd. It's in an old theater called the Union Theater.
Uh-huh.
It's just up the street from USC, and they do a lot of events there. They have a giant panorama theater. It's called the Vela Slavice. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I hope I am.
All right. Well, I'm just looking it up because I think I've heard about this. And so they have a beautiful garden in back?
Yeah, it's a beautiful meditation garden. Besides the events they do there, they usually open that up to the public.
Yeah, it was. I'm just looking at their website. Built as a motion picture hall in 1910, the Union Theater, and I'll just try and pronounce it as you did so well, Vela Slavice Panorama Theater in the West Adams USC District. Thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate you sharing with that, and I have to go back and take a look at that. Thank you very much. Alex in Long Beach emailed, my favorite is the Earl Burns Miller Japanese Garden at Cal State Long Beach. Beautiful garden and koi pond. I haven't seen that one either. Alex, thank you so much. 866-893-5722. Cindy in West Hills, what's your favorite garden in Southern California? Oh, Cindy, I'm so sorry. My fault. Go right ahead.
The bees?
Which one?
We love to go to the LA County Arboretum. It's not pristine and perfectly maintained. It's like a backyard garden in, you know, the county for everybody. We love the fact that the Huntington family is represented out there. There's history, there's peacocks, and there are lots of activities for families. I especially like the goat yoga that they do out there.
That's
so great. It's a wonderful place. It's a very happy place. We go there with friends, and we just love it.
I love the L.A. State and County Arboretum in Arcadia. Beautiful place and an incredible history as well at the Arboretum. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. We'll continue with more of our listener favorites for the gardens of Southern California on this Earth Day. We'll be back in a minute. We'll be right back. This week only, we're giving away tickets to see LAist listener and friend of Air Talk, John C. Riley. His latest vaudeville spectacle, Mr. Romantic, is on stage. Riley and his great band of multi-time Grammy winners on stage at Largo in West Hollywood. It's coming up this Saturday, April 27th. He takes the beloved tunes of the Great American Songbook and breathes new life into them. John C. Riley, Mr. Romantic, the show coming up at Largo this Saturday. To enter to win a pair of tickets, visit laist.com/Mr. Romantic, all one word. That's laist.com/Mr. Romantic. Our giveaway ends Thursday, so please make sure that you enter now. We're talking about the best gardens of Southern California. Ruth in Marina Del Rey says the San Diego Botanical Gardens that aren't in San Diego, they're in Encinitas, an amazing children's garden. Ruth, thank you for that. Jillian in Redondo Beach, where's your favorite garden here in Southern California? Ruth, go right ahead. I'm sorry, Jillian, go right ahead, please.
That's okay. My favorite garden is called South Coast Botanical Gardens, and it's off of Crenshaw Boulevard in Palos Verdes, Rancho Palos Verdes. And we would go there a lot during the pandemic because they kept certain portions of it open, and my friends and their kids, whenever they could get them out of the house. It's some of my favorite memories in this area. So.
That's great. I know it's a real regional draw, the South Coast Botanical Gardens in Rancho Palos Verdes. Jillian, thank you so much. Let's talk next with Bob in Downey. Bob, you're on Air Talk. Your favorite garden?
Yes, it's this really almost secret hidden. I mean, it's open to the public certain hours, but it's a little garden sunken below the level of the surrounding area in Little Tokyo, just south of the Japan-America Theater, maybe 50, 30 feet south of it. And you can view it from above because it's sunken. And it's a gorgeous, you don't actually have to go into it to appreciate it, but you can also go into it certain hours.
All right. Thank you, Bob. A hidden little garden behind an office building in Little Tokyo, just south of the Japanese American Theater there. Bob, thank you so much. Monica in Glendale, good to have you with us. Your favorite gardens?
Thank you, Larry. I have a few. I love visiting Descanso, as you mentioned, just because it's so walkable. You can do the whole thing in one visit. And all their plants there have really matured, all their native plants. So I love doing that walk. I once in a while will take a trip to the Natural History Museum downtown, and that is a fantastically well-kept native plants garden down there and full of kids' activities. So that's great. And then if I'm going to go on a longer drive, I mean, the Santa Barbara Botanical Gardens are just absolutely stunning, and you can spend the whole day there. There's a wonderful area for the kids to explore and play in their native plants area that's more freeform, but it's just beautiful.
I have to go see that. I've heard about the Santa Barbara Botanical Gardens. I've got to go. That sounds great. And speaking of the Santa Barbara area, Monica, thank you for your call. Bonnie and Whittier, you have another Santa Barbara County garden that you recommend?
I do, Larry. It's Lotus Land, which is in the Montecito part of Santa Barbara. It was a private estate. It's a little hard to get reservations there because of the limited parking, but it's well worth the wait. Beautiful gardens, meticulously maintained. It's a great way to spend the day.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate it. Let me share some others. Tim in Long Beach, the California Botanical Garden, just north of the Claremont Colleges, all native plants. They even sell native plants. It's just fantastic, Tim says. Tim, thank you for that one. We appreciate it. Alisa in Brentwood touts the Murphy Sculpture Garden at UCLA, says that's her favorite little secret garden. Robin Mid-Wilshire, LA, says Skyline Park in Torrance, primarily medical offices, but has beautiful raked sand gardens with river rocks. I love these. Monica in Montclair says there's a free public garden in Montclair, part of the community center. It's small but pet-friendly, all native and water-wise plants. Casper in Arcadia says the Lake Shrine Garden in Palos Verdes, absolutely beautiful. Steve in Venice, one of the most beautiful private native gardens in Los Angeles, has to be the Gottlieb in Beverly Hills. Also a must visit on the Theodore Payne Native Garden Tour, can be visited privately by appointment. Jose emailed, every time I go to Disneyland, I'm shocked at how beautiful the landscaping is. I often skip the rides and spend time looking for all the seasonal varieties Disneyland has to offer. Oh, these are so many terrific recommendations. Thank you all on this Earth Day for contributing them. Have a great day from all of us at AirTalk.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.